Welcome back, guys, to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, here joined with Brock Hammett. This week, we wanted to talk about the playoffs with them being in full swing. There's just a lot of good content there for us to discuss from a motor learning standpoint, from a ecological standpoint, a data standpoint. So it's really exciting and a bunch of good content here. So, Brock, do you want to kick us off on what you've been noticing with the playoffs from a data standpoint?
Well, the first thing is that the juice ball has somehow vanished. That's kind of been the main story, I think, for this playoffs.
You mean the allegedly juice ball?
Right. The alleged juice ball is now back to, or maybe is even further removed from being juiced, and now everyone is complaining about the ball. So that being said, it does play an effect on, you know, basically how to play the game. I think Carlos Correa last night hit a ball like 27 degrees, 103 miles per hour, which I don't remember exactly.
Wow, 103?
Well, I mean, it's not especially smashed, but I think that I had read that those balls had like typically a very high chance of being a home run, because I think he pulled it.
Do you actually want to look it up on Baseball Savant?
I could. It might take a while. So if you want to go ahead and banter a little bit while I look it up, I can do it.
Well, because one thing that you were telling me earlier while we were talking about the juice balls was, were you talking specifically about the play where Bregman got thrown out at first?
Right. So that's the other thing is that, and that kind of ties in nicely to, you know, what we like to look at, in that the play was Alex Bregman was on first and Yordan Alvarez. I actually think this was game one, I believe. So this would have been 2 nights ago. Yordan Alvarez hits a line drive. Alex Bregman takes off, and he ends up getting doubled up. Bregman later said that he had thought that all season long, balls hit at that, you know, kind of speed, the pace, and the angle typically clear the right fielder. So his perception of the ball typically would have been one that, you know, it's going to get over Judge's head, and he's going to have to try to score from first to home, but instead he ends up, Judge catches the ball and ends up doubling Bregman off. So, and that's just one example of how, you know, a change into the environment can affect the game as we see it.
Mm-hmm. Or rather a change in the task with using a different implement slash a ball that is no longer quote unquote or allegedly juiced.
Right.
And I think this is a perfect example of how the concepts laid out in ecological dynamics come into play, because Bregman was attuned to that type of information of, oh, I see this, then that ball generally ends up over his head or clearing the fence. I think we talked about last time on the podcast how at Missouri State we were in batting practice, practicing seeing ball flight and reading balls where the defenders are and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Also wonder how much Bregman, or I'm sure Bregman knew exactly where Judge was playing. And so it wasn't probably the fact that Judge just happened to be further back that time than usual, you know. And so that just shows how perception plays a big role, and anticipation plays a big role in how players play the game. And so I think that's a really good, you know, example of, you know, perception in action, not just in a traditional sense of pitcher hitter type of deal, but also with base running. And I wonder if that played well. That game they lost what 7-0. So, but still, I think that is good for players to like kind of pick up on and learn from.
I think, I mean, obviously besides that, it has an effect on kind of the intention of the athlete as far as hitting a ball at a certain angle. Because, you know, if you're doing something all season and you're getting reinforced by positive results of hitting a ball a certain way, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're not getting rewarded the same way, then you have to kind of alter your intention. So for, you know, what that would look like, the ball is traveling. I think I saw a stat that said it's traveling on average like 4 feet less. And actually, I do want to pull up a stat by Devin Fink about the percentage of like home run rate for barrels in the regular season and the postseason, because this is really interesting. Let me find it.
But I don't think that it's really affects, it definitely affects the outcomes, but I don't think, if we're training adaptable players, these guys are professionals, and I think, and we saw last night, like, they adapted. I mean, Correa hit 2 home runs. Granted, the score was way less than a normal game. It was just 3-2, and they went 10 innings. But I do think the question is more, how much does this affect pitching? Right? Like, these guys are some of the best pitchers, and then you give them a ball that doesn't now fly as far.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was hearing, I don't know if you were telling me this, but like Gerrit Cole was throwing balls back if he felt like they had raised seams, because he wanted to make sure, or no, I want to say it's the opposite, because if you have raised seams, wouldn't it not fly as far? Versus if the seams are lower, has less air resistance and drag. But anyways, still, players are understanding that, you know, the seam height on a ball affects how they're potentially the batted ball outcome.
Sure.
If a player gets a hold of it. And so we're seeing how players are trying to adapt to that as well.
So here's the stat on the barrels and the juice ball from the regular season to the postseason. So during the regular season, a barrel was a home run 59.6% of the time. During the postseason, only 49% of the time have barrels gone for home runs. So almost like, you know, a 10% difference in how often a ball is a home run from the postseason to the regular season. So obviously that, you know, is quite significant. So, like I said, how a hitter is trying to, you know, basically attack a pitcher, you know, of the ball flight that he's trying to get, of where he's trying to hit it, is completely different. So, you know, how would you adjust to that change in environment if you're a hitter and all of a sudden balls that you normally get to hit for home runs are less frequently home runs? I have some ideas, but I want to hear what you have to say.
I mean, I think this highlights the importance of a guy like Altuve. You know, this goes back to, as well, I've been thinking about, and maybe we talked about this, guys hitting and trying to hit where players are not. So if you still hit a ball well and you hit it where they're not, like in an alley or at the right launch angle with the right exit velo, that's going to beat a guy. Like those are ways to, again, we talked about this, I believe, in our first two episodes about how home runs are not everything to offensive production. So just because the balls aren't flying out as much, it just changes your strategy. So it becomes, how adaptable are you as a hitter? Can you adapt your strategy to still work with your swing, whether it's a pull swing or your goal is to do damage? What that looks like might differ you know, it might look like trying to hit doubles or something like that instead. And it to me, like, it just makes for a more exciting game from the standpoint of now we get to watch guys be more athletic, more dexterous. I now appreciate from now looking at things through an ecological lens, I appreciate like more of the flares, the flare hits, the hits that drop in front of like fielders, you know, between the infield and the outfield. Like that becomes, if you're able to do it in high pressure situations on a consistent basis, that's to me is actually quite impressive.
Yeah. I think it's cool that you know, through your learning, you've gotten a greater appreciation of those type of things that maybe other people wouldn't. That being said, I still think that the home run is probably the most exciting thing.
Oh, absolutely.
That can happen in baseball. So I'm not like necessarily like disagreeing with you. It's like, it's cool that I don't know if it's better necessarily.
But it's like, if you've heard of Ichiro's like, oh, the home runs are super sexy. But for him, it was more of a sign of skill being able to collect hits. Now, whether or not that was valuable to collect a bunch of hits versus, you know, hit for extra base or yeah, extra base power. There is a certain level of skill. And what I now appreciate is I think of it a little bit more like tennis or like ping pong, right? Like you can hit it hard and smash it. And there's times where that's appropriate, but there are other times where it takes a lot of skill and strategy to recognize the situation in the game where a certain hit is going to work just fine. And it's going to be like that because of the pitch, because the pitchers are difficult to hit. They're throwing with movement. Those pitches may only afford certain types of batted ball contact. And so one of the things that we want to do as coaches in our training environments is create scenarios that allow them to perceive those affordances and be able to interact with them, meaning be able to understand how to take a pitch like a slider or whatever away and be able to drive it the opposite direction. Maybe at times learn how to hit a ball with fade to the line, you know, over between maybe the second baseman and first baseman with some hook towards the line, because balls hit down the line can go for doubles. It depends too where guys are positioning you, because it seems now like outfielders are more shifted towards the lines because they want to protect against that. So just having an understanding though of how the defense is playing you, and then trying to again grow athletes' toolboxes, or essentially in my mind increase the affordances that they're able to perceive and interact with.
I think that for me, it's just because of how ballistic hitting is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a lot harder to place, so to speak, where you're hitting the ball as far as like location. So I think like focusing on that may not
this
be.
This is where I want to find out though, tennis, because those guys freaking hit the ball when they get served.
Sure.
That ball's moving pretty fast, and they can put some pretty serious spin on it. And so I do agree that it's hard, but hitting a baseball that's moving really fast is super hard, and putting it over the fence is super hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to acknowledge that the human body is pretty amazing, and the movement system is really amazing, and it's able to coordinate and do those things. And we're not talking about doing it every single time. We're talking about doing it at maybe like a 30 to, or probably like a 25 to a 30% of the time being able to do that.
Right.
And we're not talking about putting it, we're not pitching, right? When we're talking about hitting, we're not trying to hit a smaller target. We have the whole field.
Right.
So really what you're asking of hitters is not like, it's not necessarily trying to aim it, but it is learning how to perceive the information of the pitch and understand what that pitch affords in terms of a type of swing that you can get a successful outcome from that type of pitch. So maybe talking about it more in terms of trying to place a ball might not be the best way to describe it, but it is about trying to put a ball in a general direction.
Right.
And I think that is within the realm of possibility, especially at the elite levels, because you hear all the time about guys in the big leagues talking about, you know, everybody sees the home run. And I think, I can't remember if it was Votto or Donaldson talking about this, but all the pro guys who are really good, they can hit the ball to any part of the park whenever they want to. And
I would say in batting practice.
For sure.
I would say not in the game. They can hit it wherever they want because it's so much of hitting is reactionary, and that, you know, because of what the pitch allows for, you know, you can't always go the other way on a fastball inside, you know.
Oh, for sure.
It and to an extent, like.
But that, so this is good because now we can talk about like what affordance means, right? Opportunity for action. And an inside pitch doesn't really afford very well going the opposite way. Is it possible? Sure. But that's not the greatest affordance for an inside pitch.
If it's Jeter, it's all you do, but.
Right. But point being is that each pitch, based upon its movement and its location, will have a different affordance in terms of what a good outcome could be in terms of your action. So that's more of like trying to understand affordances and trying to constrain the athlete. So by constrain the athlete, maybe it's throwing different types of pitches, pitch sequences, so that they can pick up the specifying information there in regards to, you know, picking up spin, whether it's picking up movement in terms of picking it up out of the hand, and being able to then read that movement and then pick up the affordances that that movement affords the hitter to be able to either hit it the other way, hit it up the middle, hit it over an infielder's head, hit it over an outfielder's head, hit it into the gap. I mean, we're not completely changing necessarily people's approaches. Like, I think approaches that people have of like, hey, we want to try to hit the ball to the middle of the field, or maybe we'll split that plate in half and balls that are in, we're trying to pull to left center, balls that are outer half, we're trying to go to right center. Like, it can be as simple as that. Or it can be, you know, if you wanted to make it a little bit more complex, you know, fastballs we're trying to pull, and off speed pitches we're trying to go the other way. Like, that could be another way to simplify it. But that's more how thinking about it from an ecological approach, you can begin to look at hitting.
Yeah. I think one of the more interesting things for me in hitting is just strategy, you know, and it's kind of what you were talking about as far as approach, but it's also something that we've talked about as far as like, you know, ecological design, is just the intention of the athlete and how much changing the intention can, you know, garner new results or positive results. And there's just so much of your approach is dependent on, I mean, a lot can go into it. So What are the hitter's strengths? What are the pitcher's strengths? What are the hitter's weaknesses? What are the pitcher's weaknesses? And then you also have the context of the game itself. What's the count? How many runners are on? And you can just kind of go down the line. So as far as like the approach or the intent of the athlete, you know, you can really get kind of creative about, you know, it's so dynamic. Like, it changes from pitch to pitch. And so the intention of the athlete has to change from pitch to pitch. And that's kind of what I'm interested in, is like understanding each context within the environment and kind of trying to have the the best intent possible, the best approach possible for a given circumstance. So, for instance, if it's a 3-0 count, you know, there's some there, we're looking to have a certain batted ball, right? We're trying to hit it, you know, probably trying to pull it in the air. Whereas, you know, if we're down 0-2, we're allowing, you know, we're giving more of an affordance for kind of that flare hit, you know, like you were talking about. So I think that the intention kind of shifts from pitch to pitch.
I think maybe not necessarily always from pitch to pitch, but depending upon the count, right? There's probably, you know, a plus count versus a, you know, negative count. Mm-hmm. Essentially, to me, plus count would be anything, huh?
Even counts as well.
Yeah. But I mean, anytime you have two strikes, that's more what I'm thinking. Like, whether you're not, in a, if you're in a, like, non-two-strike count, I think you can be very aggressive. Even if it's a like a 1-1 count, I think you can still, your intention can stay consistent with your game plan. But this is where I think it's good to step back and kind of, I want to play with something that ecological approach kind of posits, is that we don't necessarily need to have the athlete being super conscious all the time and changing their intention consciously. Like, it more comes back to having the athlete being more goal directed. So being in tune with the information in the environment, and as the information changes in the environment, their intention / strategy shifts. And I want to plug the other thing that I'm a part of, Emergence, and their course that they put out. And one of the things that they talk about in their course is that that information is power, and it's everywhere, and it's like it's always talking to you. Mm-hmm. And so one of the papers that I've been going through recently has been talking about resonance, and how more so the fact of like the human movement system or your central nervous system becoming attuned, like a radio becomes attuned to a station. Like, we want to get our athlete to become in attuned to the information in the environment and the specifying information. So that being like getting dialed into a specific frequency. And so when we're thinking about it that way, then the athlete doesn't necessarily need to be as conscious. Like, they can be in more of a flow state. Like, the information just kind of comes to them, and it's kind of just like us talking. Like, we don't have to heavily process what we're saying. It just, the information comes in, we interact with it, and boom, we speak. Have you ever thought about how the words that you're looking for come actually to the forefront and actually come out? Like, you're not consciously thinking of the words that are coming out of your mouth. They're just like literally coming out.
Yeah. Let it be known, Garrett's actively trying to give me the yips as we do this podcast so that I cannot actually form any like coherent thoughts. Now I'm thinking about how words are coming to me, but no, that's great. And I'm all on board for like flow state. And, you know, I've definitely felt in my experience as a player, being overly conscious takes away from kind of the task at hand. But at the same time, I think there's probably a lot of it is just like being familiar and mm-hmm. just like understanding how different changes in the environment, you know, having already dealt with that before. So then, you know, your change of intention as the environment changes can be more automatic. So I think it's kind of just like, maybe we don't do a good enough job as coaches of creating environments that give like a realistic change. So, you know, if we're doing batting practice, right, we're not mm-hmm. doing specific counts, right? We're not going through like different mm-hmm. changes in counts. So hitters aren't having to actively, you know, practice how they're kind of changing their strategy, their approach from mm-hmm. as the counts change. So that's just a really, you know, that's the first thing that I think of is like, well, we're probably not doing a good enough job of creating environments where they can become more familiar with mm-hmm. the changes that they'll see in the game.
And that just comes back to the concept of attunement. The other component that I wanted to talk about as well is calibration. So for example, let's go back to Bregman. He was attuned to the information being a certain way, and all of a sudden it changes. So then he has to recalibrate, and I'm assuming in future he's not going to make the same mistake. And so that's where, you know, to what you're talking about, to speak to it from an ecological perspective and use ecological terminology, we want to have within our practice design time for them to learn how to recalibrate. Because like even within an at bat, they may need to make adjustments, or which, because essentially making adjustments is to a certain extent recalibrating. And this is where having potentially like, here's like a practice design idea. Maybe don't have the same BP thrower the entire time of BP, like actually switch it.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe, for example, to simulate the, let's say you had three, your hitters only got three rounds. You could adjust this if we're going four, but let's say you're going 3 to 4 rounds. On the first two rounds, it's the same BP thrower. On round three, new one hops in to simulate a change, a reliever coming in, and having to now have to recalibrate and adjust to a new arm action,
mm-hmm.
maybe a new velocity, maybe a ball that spins differently. Those types of things are little simple ways that you can apply an ecological approach. And that's the thing too, is I think people, you know, want to say that it's super hard or difficult. And it's like, how hard is it to find two BP throwers and one that doesn't throw as much, you know, to have them hop in on the third round or their fourth round?
Yeah, it's doable.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and so, you know, you can, having that switch, like that's going to force them to have to learn how to adjust. So that's one simple thing that I think coaches can apply right away.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And it's kind of like, I guess the root of what we were trying to get at is how can we get our hitters to be like in a better state of flow state, so they don't have to be as conscious about, you know, recalibrating for,
mm-hmm.
you know, each at bat, each pitch, et cetera. So the more live that we can, you know, the more we can replicate that in practice, I think the easier they can, you know, I don't like to use the word optimize, you know, because I think that it's not necessarily possible all the time to do that.
We just have to reframe the definition of optimize.
Right.
Like you want to optimize for the moment, meaning what can you do right now to make your situation better than it was before?
Right.
And part of the thing too with recalibration, initially as coaches, we need to help facilitate and guide athletes and bring their attention to these sorts of things that can help, to use your word, optimize their approach. And
right.
And so initially, I would, if I'm working with players, like I would let them know of this idea, this concept of, hey, we need to make sure you're recalibrating, you know, and here are the things I want to bring your attention to when information that looks like this, you start noticing this type of information. Hey, maybe that's a sign you need to recalibrate.
Mm-hmm.
And then giving them a process by which, you know, or a tool. I think a tool is a better word, because if I give somebody a tool, this goes back to another concept, and I think we might have talked about this before, exploration and calibration, right? I want to give you a tool that you can go and explore with and learn more about yourself, your environment, and develop better strategies to get there quicker so that you can become more efficient, get attuned, reattuned, or recalibrated in a more effective and timely manner. Because again, hitting is really difficult because you don't get to stand in there necessarily. And when a guy's warming up and actually get a real perspective until you're actually in the box, and then now it's counting.
Right.
And maybe your best pitch that you're going to see is that first one. So
I'd say oftentimes it is too.
Mm-hmm. But at the same point, like, to flip that back around, some guys actually don't do well swinging at the first pitch. They do better seeing a pitch. And so I think this comes back to the data, you know, collecting that data and figuring out which guys are the ones that do well, especially at the lower levels, which guys do well seeing a pitch first, so that they can kind of, in a sense, get calibrated to the new pitcher. And then they actually hit with a much better average after they've seen one pitch. But we don't want to make it cookie cutter like the A's used to do and make every guy take the first pitch. But right. It probably would be true for a small subset of players.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that because the Astros pretty much figured out that Austin Meadows for the Rays really wanted to like see a pitch. Like he had one of the lowest swing rates on first pitch in the MLB. And Austin Meadows, for those that don't know, had a really big breakout year. So he's a really good hitter. So like you said, that may be something that helps him. That being said, the Astros knew that, and so that's how they attacked him. And so
did they do a good job of neutralizing him?
Yes, that he struggled all series. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the pendulum swinging. It goes back and forth. You kind of have to predict.
But wouldn't you say then, as a coaching staff, like you want to know and understand your athletes' strengths and weaknesses. So at some point, if you knew that he's showing this trend,
right,
and this trend is very obvious, you would then want to train him to have the flexibility to be comfortable swinging at the first pitch, because eventually other teams are going to pick up on it, and then they're going to start attacking him very early in the count. And then that would be a good time for him to, if he's been practicing it, start ambushing a fastball early in the count.
It might not be that he necessarily, and I actually expect it to be this way. I don't think he's necessarily worse on the first pitch than he is on any other pitches. It's the fact that he just didn't swing as much, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're essentially giving the pitcher a free strike to start the at bat, then when you start it from there, then of course you're going to struggle from the rest of the at bat. But you know, when you look at the season that he had, I'm sure that pitchers were staying away from him because, you know, he's a significantly above average hitter. So it might not be something that got that people noticed over the long course of the season. So you know, he didn't really have to necessarily, you know, he could get away with it because people weren't challenging him with the first pitch as much. But pretty much in every single at bat, it was, you know, a fastball in the heart of the plate that he chose not to swing at, which I'm sure he's worse on those pitches that happened to be first. It's just that he didn't even offer at it.
Yeah. No, and I think that's where hopefully, you know, you can develop a game plan with your hitter and then practice it and get him comfortable with trying to now accept that affordance. Because before he was rejecting it and utilizing it to get comfortable.
Right.
And then it starts getting used against him. So then you want to try to, you know, utilize that then to your advantage.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's not something that you necessarily have to design. Sometimes it can just be, you know, a conversation. You know, he might not be aware that, you know, because he's just doing what's comfortable to him. So it's like, hey, you know, do you know you don't swing at, you know, first pitches very much? And just kind of getting to the bottom of, like, what's the process behind that?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes it can just be enabling an athlete and just saying, hey, you know, you can do this. You know, it's not that you don't have to, but just giving him the freedom, because you don't really know. There could be, you know, past context. Well, my coach always said I should see a pitch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so just, like, giving them the option to do that, hopefully they won't have, you know, a trend like Meadows had where it was so easily exploitable for the Astros.
Mm-hmm.
What else you got?
So on the calibration side, one of the things too that I think I was trying to remember. So I was recently listening to a couple podcasts lately, and one of them was talking about calibration in the sense of it's how our body perceives, like, ourselves in relation to the environment and how we know where we are in relation to other things. And so they were looking at, Rob Gray was talking about this in his latest podcast, at dart throwers and how initially, and this is where it actually, I think, kind of may apply to baseball and will bring up some good questions, is a person's first attempt at something oftentimes is less accurate. So when they were looking at dart throwers, their first throw tended to deviate the most from their other throws because they were able to, they get to throw three in a row. And their first one, yeah. But so their first one relative to their others had a higher rate of miss in the vertical axis. And that then versus like when people on their next couple of throws, and I think we've talked about this before on how it's easier to coordinate when things are continuously moving. And so if you're able to go one right after the other, just like in BP, if you're able to hit one right after the other, it's easier for you to coordinate. It's easier for you to get into a rhythm. But then the question is, all right, now we bring this back to baseball. Well, what do we do when the first pitch you often will see is the best pitch that you're going to get? That's also when you're at your weakest point in terms of being able to coordinate the best to actually hit the ball well. Not that it's impossible. Like there's plenty of evidence to show that guys are able to pounce on the first pitch. But, you know, from the research, it also tells us that at times when there's a delay, that can mess with our ability to coordinate. And so trying to have different, this is where, like, I really like feel moves or reps, because you're directly talking with the nervous system and helping your body realize where it is in space and what it's doing. Because again, Rob Gray talked about, like, calibration can be as simple as, like, okay, you pick up a new bat, move it around, you take the donut off, move it around so that you can recalibrate and your body has now good awareness of where that object is in space, and when you move it, what type of feedback you get.
I think that that's really interesting about just like the dart throws and like getting into a rhythm, and just like how, again, we don't design very good environments that scale to the game, because oftentimes a BP round is, you know, I would make a joke about my coach in college who he was like, Will Ferrell in the movie Elf with the snowballs, where he would just, like, you know, it's just like rapid fire.
Uh-huh.
And that is when you're having to, like, literally, like, you make contact with the ball and then immediately, like, start your load for the next swing.
Uh-huh.
That legitimately never happens. So that kind of, like, calibration, you know, where I'm like, okay, say that first pitch in BP, I hooked it. Mm-hmm. So then I'm immediately like, okay, I need to get under it more. And it's just like completely
different. It allows you to calibrate way easier.
But I don't think
but in an unrealistic way.
That's not good because, mm-hmm. you know, in the game, first pitch, say you foul one straight back. Okay, you were under it. You take a step out of the box, you do your batting gloves, you pick up your sign from the coach. You know, it's like 10 to 15 seconds
mm-hmm.
before you even take another swing. But all of our practice and calibration, you know, like you're saying, is typically in batting practice or even in cage work, flips, you name it. It's all extremely fast.
And this is where we go back to, if we're going to go again through a constraint-led approach, let's go back to the organism or the individual. Their mental state plays a huge factor on their ability to coordinate. And how much do we actually practice that? I mean, everybody talks about competitive mindset or edge. You know, like do players have like a competitive nature? And I think that can be trained. That's why people talk about, or coaches talk about, like creating a culture of competitiveness. But how much of that is also worked on in practice? Like, I don't think enough coaches practice the mental side of the game. And like, because it seems to be more about trying to burn into muscle memory a certain mechanic versus, and in that process, they do quantity over quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be more beneficial to spend more time on the mental side of things and then being really locked in to execute a rep, because that's what's going to happen in the game. Like, the game, you know, has, you're only going to take maybe, I don't know, anywhere from 4 to maybe 15 swings. And really, you're only going to have a handful that are actually going to go in play, meaning like probably 1 to 4 if you're lucky, right? You don't go for 0-for with strikeouts.
Yeah. It's funny to see how it all kind of like plays off each other, because, you know, if you don't give the athlete time to kind of, you know, mentally compete, it's kind of the same thing for not allowing them a chance to get good at, you know, shifting their intention. So it's really, they're all kind of interconnected as far as like, you know, giving them a chance to get more familiar with the environment instead mm-hmm. of like having this like rapid fire, like, I guess, physical calibration, whereas like there's probably more
everything's linked. And right. This is where the ecological approach or dynamic systems theory comes into play, and taking a systems approach and looking at the whole system. Like, you can't divorce the brain and the body. Like, those two things need to
mm-hmm.
work together. And, you know, one of the old school, the Mental Game of Baseball book talks about that. I remember there's a chapter with Charlie Brown and the cartoon talking about like how his mind and his body haven't spoken in years. And so, like, similarly, how as coaches are we trying to reinforce that mind-body connection? And I think that plays well with a ecological approach or ecological dynamics approach.
Yeah, so we've kind of just kind of looked at like how we can get better just from like a batting practice standpoint
mm-hmm.
and just like getting a batting practice that scales more. So if we want to just kind of recap, I think some things that would be good that I would personally endorse, and if I was a coach, I would do is, you know, the first thing I think we said is introducing different counts and having players be aware of how their intention might shift based on the count and their personal abilities.
Mm-hmm.
The second you said was, you know, maybe bring in different guys to pitch so that they're having to get used to a different arm action, a different speed, tempo, cadence.
Mm-hmm.
Again, very easy to do. And then the third thing would be taking more time in between pitches, and letting the hitter maybe mentally calibrate and balance that with the physical, opposed to the rapid fire nature of batting practice. And I get that there's logistic challenges, and the batting practice goes a certain speed in a certain way for a reason. But, you know, I also think there could be like a less is more kind of approach to.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and there's already like added benefits for like volume control of swings anyway. So it's like, well, what if instead of four rounds of six, you know, what if we did, you know, two rounds of six and hitters got more of a, you know, a realistic time in between pitches where they had to, again, go through a change in their intention based on the count and the pitcher, their skill sets, et cetera. Because I really think that's going to scale more to the game, and that's how you're going to create athletes that have a lot more flow state in game, because they're already practicing going through this mental recalibration that they're going to go through in the game.
So one of the things that we've been doing at Missouri State is we've actually shortened some of our rounds, or what we tried to do, or we've experimented with this fall, is shortening the rounds, or at least some of the rounds. And we did rounds of three. And like one of the things too with that I saw was that our first swings sometimes, to actually counter what we had talked about, how difficult it can be, there is some research to show that when you're cold, you actually are a little bit tighter. So meaning like your fast twitch is actually a little bit, you have a little bit more output. And so that might be, because I always felt too, when I first started, if I were to go up a little bit cold, like I had to get ready to hit more quickly, my first couple of swings actually off the tee were actually felt like the ball was coming off really hard, and then it dropped back. And it's this weird thing, and I don't know if you've experienced it, but when you like go in the cage and you take lots of reps, like the first couple, you know, maybe the first four or five are like really good, and you get greedy and you want more. And you're like, all right, I'm going to go 10 for 10. And then it starts going downhill, and you're like, oh, I got to get back to that, you know, three for three. And then you just keep going and going. I think that's another reason why longer rounds in BP just don't make sense. Because from a physiological standpoint with your body, it actually tends to be more fresh at the beginning of a round. And so when, like, that's why you sometimes see a guy come off the bench and hit well, because he actually is a little bit, his body is a little bit tighter. It's not as loose and warmed up, and he's actually able to have a little bit more pop. And so that was another thing that I actually noticed, was that oftentimes guys' rounds looked a lot better if they just had one swing, because they hit a nice line drive with good carry, good backspin. It looked great. And then they're like next two swings roll over, you know, chopper or whatever. And you're like, or like pop up. And it's like, huh, maybe we should just go to shorter rounds, because like they oftentimes do well off of like the first pitch to a certain extent. And then you can even work approach. And that's one of the things that I've noticed with our hitters, they kind of struggle with that a little bit, especially because that's not how they've grown up practicing the game. Like that's not how BP has worked before.
Nobody has. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think players, you know, this is how context actually influences motor behavior. So for them, when they get into that situation, their mindset is different than in a game situation. And so that may be why, you know, a guy looks good in BP but bad in a game, or a guy looks bad in BP and is good in a game. And so this speaks to the fact that we may need to change how we do BP to get them more in a game mindset of actually, you know, this, I don't really like how we talk about decision training, because oftentimes decision training is devoid of perception action. It's just perception. And so, but to go back to that, hitters need to be able to discriminate and basically improve their affordance capability, like opportunities for action, but also opportunities for inaction. So improve their discriminatory ability to be able to decipher which pitches to swing at pitches not to swing at. Because again, like we talked about before in the example that you gave of the coach just snowball, throwing, just fire him in there.
Imagine a coach like allowing a player to take a pitch in batting practice. Never happens.
It does when they swing at a pitch that's outside the zone.
Oh, and then you get, you know, then you get scolded. But if you take a pitch that's borderline, then you're going to get...
Oh, that's a strike.
then you actually, at least in my experience, you take a pitch that the coach thought was a strike, just throws like a tantrum, and then kicks you out of the cage. So like you said, we're completely like not even... practicing one of the most important skill sets is that you said before discrimination. I said, you know, discernment of like, hey, I have to decide what I should be swinging at, what I shouldn't be. But in batting practice, it's, I know that I'm automatically swinging at everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's another reason why traditional batting practice is bad.
Well, that it has a lot of room for improvement.
Okay. That's Garrett's politically correct way of saying that, you know, but
yeah,
I'll be a little harsher on traditional batting practice and college baseball in general, because it just, like you said, it has a lot of room for improvement. That's nice.
Well, I mean, if we're going to get people to actually listen to us,
yeah, we probably should actually apply it. Everyone.
I mean, but that's one of the things that, you know, has been difficult to learn is framing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Both as a catcher and as a coach. But, yeah, so hopefully those are some practical or useful practical things that you guys can apply. Looking forward to having more good stuff come out of the playoffs for us to talk about. Brock, do you have anything that you want to close us out with?
No, that was great. I think we're much like – you know, batting practice has room for improvement. So is our podcast. And every week I feel like we get a little bit better. So this is great. Yeah.
All right. Until next time, guys, you can find us on Twitter at gboyum01 and brock21.
Yep.
All right. Hit us up on there. Let us know what you think, things that you want us to cover, questions that you may have. Let us know what you think. Till next time.